when I think about Vice President Kamala Harris's recent Diwali celebration, there were a lot, and if not a majority, of Indian or Bengali influencers that were part of this beautiful celebration, but they're not the only ones to celebrate Diwali. When I look at the churches that I go to now, I actually enjoy the church experience that include people, all different types of Guyanese people. And that's from Black Guyanese to Indo-Guyanese. Mm-hmm. But then also there's Chinese Guyanese. And then there's people who are, you know, more native or Arawak Indian Guyanese. Like, there is such a large diaspora. Mm-hmm. And I might not have enough following to be invited to the vice president's, you know, Diwali celebration, but I also celebrate Diwali and probably go to church than most of those influencers there.
Welcome to Real Talk Unfiltered. I'm Catherine Ali Zaslavsky.
And I'm Raymond Liu.
And we're about to dive deep into the experiences of trusted leaders in our community and get real about the issues facing Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders.
Here, we don't rely on sound bites. We make space for the unfiltered truth of AAPI existence to make the political personal.
Let's dive in. On today's episode, we're joined by Sarita Nath, an award-winning social media strategist and Indo-Caribbean beauty influencer and creative producer. She advocates for diversity, inclusion, and change in the beauty industry by spotlighting and elevating cultural conversations in marginalized spaces, from her work with America's Next Top Model to creating VH1's first digital beauty series, Black Girl Beauty. Make sure you follow her on social media, at Sarita Nath, to learn more about her work. Welcome to the show, Sarita. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine. Hi, Raymond. How are you?
Good. Nice to meet you. Love your stuff. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Great. Likewise.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of questions.
Let's dive right into it.
Let's dive in. Yeah. So before we start, I mean, people are going to know you. They're going to know your work. They're going to have followed you on social media. But for anyone who doesn't know you, tell us who you are, introduce us to what you do, what your identity is, like how you fit into this broad, as we know, very diverse API experience.
So I will say that my brand has grown and evolved the same way that I have also grown and evolved as a woman. And for me, for years, I didn't really know where I fit in. I just knew that I was good at a lot of different things. So over the years, I have definitely nailed down what I'm good at. I would like to proudly say that I am an Indo-Caribbean beauty influencer and a producer, senior social media manager at VH1, and overall someone who just likes to be a great mental health advocate and work towards building a better community for my culture.
Mm-hmm. And that's so real, too. Like, when you talk about the journey and how many years it's taken, I mean, people who are listening to this and who have listened to other episodes will know that I'm Indo-Guyanese. I'm proudly Indo-Caribbean, proudly like who I am, where I am right now. But it's a really long journey to figure that out, because like, how do you figure out who you are when you don't see representation around you? And like, we're Indo-Guyanese. And so, yeah, like we are very, very underrepresented in basically everything. You work in television right now, so I feel like you're probably feeling that really deeply. But like, this is true of anyone in the API experience. Like, we are the most underrepresented when we look at media, when we look at politics, economics, like everything. We're so underrepresented, and so it's hard to figure out who you are.
I will say that growing up, I really didn't have an understanding of who I was culturally. I was born in Guyana. I left it when I was 3 years old and was raised in Belize, Central America. And from there, I quickly moved to America after 5 years of being in a predominantly Spanish-speaking country. And coming from a family who was the only brown family in a very large Spanish community, to not really knowing or understanding my culture, heritage outside of my immediate family, coming to America, coming to New York, Queens, it was a huge culture shock because I felt sort of disengaged from what my actual community and culture was like in general. I only saw what was being presented to me. I never saw or felt Guyanese or represented internally enough. So I feel like a lot of times you can be surrounded by your own people, but you can also feel like you don't really fit in. And I never felt like I fit in my culture. I never felt that I was Guyanese enough. I never felt that I assimilated to my culture, never mind I was felt more American than anything. So I will say that being Indo-Caribbean, as you already know, Catherine, that you can walk into several different spaces and definitely feel like you are fit many boxes. But at the end of the day, when you fill out like government forms, you press that Asian box and that's the only option that you have sometimes.
Yes. Oh, sweet Jesus. Yeah.
And I'm sure that, you know, if you don't look like if anyone's seen me, I've gotten many different ethnicities over the years. I've gotten straight up African American.
What's the most common one?
Oh, I will say people have said, oh, you're Dominican. And there are people who are New York natives who will say, oh, you're Guyanese. And it's great because they know who you are because they also
might have. I was going to say.
Yeah, they might have someone who is Guyanese. But when I first met you, Catherine, I could not tell that you were Indo-Caribbean until you spoke about it. Mm-hmm. The beautiful thing about Asian culture is that we're not a monolith and we come in different shades, varieties, backgrounds. And I think that that is what's beautiful. And that's what's missing in today's media and in representation in general.
What's the wildest guess you've gotten?
I will say that while a lot of times we feel like we have to check a box when we do official paperwork, when it comes to explaining that you're a Guyanese to people outside of your culture, I've often been told, oh, you're from Ghana. And that sort of distinction is very, very much not the same. Two different continents, two different countries. And so,
or like Guinea, like.
Yeah, like French Guyana. And I'm just like, explain the geography of Guyana for me, seeing that you know so much.
Right.
So that will have to be the wildest thing. It's not necessarily what I look like, but essentially where I come from. And it's crazy because Guyana has such a huge influence in ways that people don't really know or understand. Mm-hmm. I will say the Caribbean community in general, there's also a weird place that we sit on sort of the Asian scale, which has always made it harder for us to fit in.
So you said that growing up, kind of had a period of figuring out kind of who you were culturally, kind of where you're coming from, moved around a lot. While you were growing up in New York, though, what was the type of culture or the environment that you felt you could somewhat gravitate towards, where you found some kind of sense of belonging? Because the culture that I was kind of involved with was just like typical American culture and just pop culture, movies. And so I just kind of grew up in that environment. So for you, what was that like? What was something that you kind of, just your interests growing up?
So when it comes to where I fit in growing up, I will say that I straddled between both the African-American community and the white community in America, or like especially in New York when it's a melting pot of people. Mm-hmm. I will say that after middle school, going to school in the city, I met a lot of different people, but I definitely felt and gravitated more towards the Black community because I was also brown. I also, my hair was kinkier. You know, I have more Afrocentric features, larger lips, a larger nose. I didn't see that many Guyanese people in the spaces that I started to gravitate towards in media and entertainment. Mm-hmm. And if they were, they were Afro-Caribbean. So that was definitely where I felt more comfortable. And that is where I found a lot of my work to be more successful because I still have my own struggles as a brown woman.
Mm. That's real.
For me, I think it's funny. I gravitated towards, quote unquote, like the white culture, American culture. Like I listened to punk rock music and emo. I had emo phase and I was, I guess, essentially more white aligning when I was growing up. But then it's interesting because I never felt like they were intentionally trying to ostracize me because obviously I didn't look like any of them. But looking back at it now, I could see like I was always that Asian kid. You know, I don't know if they were microaggressions. I guess you could categorize it as such.
I feel like it doesn't even matter what you're going to say. They're like going to be like macroaggressions.
Right. Yeah, probably.
Like we can hear racism coming.
But I guess I never took it as malicious. But then as I grew up older, you know, similar to your experience, Sarita, like I found that the communities of color, people of color were a lot more empathetic, a lot more accepting, a lot more like cool with me, like fitting in. And I was like, oh, just gravitate towards that a lot more as I grew up older. Not that I hate white people or anything like that, but I just felt like
there's a poll quote in there that says you know, I hate white people.
100%. I'm gonna edit myself
right.
I just felt like there was much
more interest, you know, and more culture, more fun.
I understand 100% where you're coming from because in college, I went to a school that, sure, I went to a school that was diverse. All of my friends from college are predominantly white. So I grew up in my early 20s, going upstate, you know, going to vineyards, going to, you know, out east in Long Island, just hiking, doing a lot of things that are considered quote unquote white people shit. Right. But I did not grow up with an identity of my own. And because I didn't, I never really had sort of that. It made me actually look at my culture and question it a little bit more and say, why? And I actually tweeted this just today that growing up Caribbean, I wasn't taught to exercise or to how to properly like be in activities or sports other than a sport that is not necessarily celebratory of women being in it, i.e. cricket.
Cricket.
Exactly. So like because we're not growing up in that, like especially American families like watching like baseball and whatnot, like young girls are taught to do ballet and so on. They also have their struggles there. But because I never grew up like doing soccer or, you know, actually running around, it was constantly a state of struggle that I never was able to form an identity that was promoting healthy habits within my physical body and my mental stability as well. And I think so many Asian households across the diaspora can agree and relate to that, because if we're not seeing ourselves as athletic, or, you know, other people who are athletes, then we're not really being promoted or taught, oh, well, girls can do that. Caribbean girls can be athletic in that way. We're always taught, put your head down in the books, but then also get married, but we're not going to teach you how to actually like embrace your beauty at a young age. So that way you can be someone outside of marriage or being partnered. There's, you know, that I feel like that is something that a lot of like minorities have to struggle with. But I will say that for me currently in this journey where I've lost a lot of weight and I've go to the gym every single day, I don't really see a lot of people who look like me, or I'm happier now that the gym that I go to, I see a lot of people who look like me, more men than I do women, who are working out because it does help your mental stability overall. Just because that is like the biggest thing when it comes to seeing how your white friends grew up and how their parents treated them and the things they were able to quote unquote get away with. And then you think about yourself with, never mind, you feel embraced and you feel like, you know, you can let those microaggressions slide off from time to time. Once you kind of outgrow those friends and you come into your own and your own people, then you actually are able to analyze everything around you and hold the people around you accountable. Culturally,
what's your workout routine? What are we talking about? Are we going HIIT
workout
cardio?
This is what Ray got from that conversation about belonging, about community.
No, there's two ends.
I want to know, how many reps do you do? How do you bounce the cardio? How do you bounce the weights? This is what we need to know, Sarita. This is what we got you on the show.
The only reason why, and you know what, I will say that no shame in that question by any means necessary. I work out every day of the week.
There you go.
I need to be in the gym over an hour and a half now. I hit at least 20 to 30 minutes of cardio. I do all of my supersets and I can deadlift 165.
Ooh,
and
there
then
we go.
I can gravity leg press.
That's almost me.
620 pounds, which I'm sure that if I go to a non-LA fitness gym, they're not paying me for this. Maybe 620 pounds might feel a little bit more like 620 pounds. But definitely,
who's to say?
Definitely, I will say that as someone who has a strong background in jiu-jitsu, I have a blue belt in Gracie jiu-jitsu, and currently I have a trainer, but also I will say that I do horseback riding now, which is goes into this cultural thing that we talk about, which is like, I know people say move in silence, don't tell people what you do, but I think it's important for me to talk about like why I like, even at horseback riding, I feel like I sometimes look around, this is like, this is some white people shit right here that doing. But I will say that how, as much as I adore my trainer and the people that I have around me, I don't see people that look like me. I think that it's something that learning a new sport, learning something that allows for me to have discipline and structure and posture and composure in many different ways. And also dealing with something as majestic as a horse versus a ball and a bat is definitely something that I was like, if I'm going to do a sport, I'm going to probably do the most difficult one. And
I'm sure you feel regal as soon as you're riding on that horse, right? Like royalty. You got it.
I'm ready for the horse photo
shoot.
You
say that, and then you see the mirror when you get up to the side of the mirror. You're like, oh shit. Because I'm 5 feet tall and I'm sure jockeys are just as short as I am, but I also think that, you know, working out allows for me to alleviate that sort of insecurity that I have about being heavier than a horse, which is not physically possible. But I will say that it does allow for me to stay focused. And that is the biggest thing, is that you should not look down, because if you look down, you're not in control anymore. Mm-hmm. And the lessons that I'm learning within that process, it allows for you to have control, but also keep your composure. Mm-hmm. Not an easy thing to do. And maybe there is a horse photo shoot in my future, Catherine, maybe. But I also would only want to do something like that when I feel like I've earned it.
Moral of the story, don't mess with Sarita. She will come after you with her horse.
Moral of the story, produce a Lifetime movie about Sarita's journey.
It's not the first time I've heard that. It's not the first time I've heard it. And my sister calls me horse girl now. And I'm just it's funny because when I tell this story, when I say these things to my mother, it's like, yeah, but in growing up in Guyana, we had horses. I'm like, it's not the same thing by any means necessary.
It's not. No.
And I think that that is where often culturally, like, it goes back to, oh, you working out? Oh, that's a thing that you do. Why are you gone for an hour and a half? I'm like, because when I'm there, it allows for me to focus myself on a goal and learn how to get there. And I think that that
is a stress reliever.
It's stress relieving, because everybody knows that being a minority is a lot of stress when you have to deal with that in your household. Mm-hmm. You have to deal with societal pressures. You have to deal with expectations. You have to deal with, especially when you grow up, not feeling like you fit in and trying to find your own tribe. Mm-hmm. Working out is one of those outlets that allow for you to have control over your own autonomy of your own body and everything. And you don't have to worry about those things that we have to kind of deal with during work, friendship, relationships, and so on and so forth.
I appreciate how you're relating this conversation on well-being, belonging to community, because there is something. Okay, so first of all, I need to own that, like, there's things that both you and Ray are talking about that, like, really, really hit me right in the heart. Like, I grew up mostly in white areas. Most of my friends are white at this point, because most of the people I've met in spaces where I would find friends are white. And when you say horse riding is white people shit, let me tell you, I'm currently with my roommate, who is one of my closest friends, who is a horse girl, self-identified horse girl, is from Long Island, does the hiking, just came back from a walk around our area to check out the foliage. Like, when I interact with people who are from different backgrounds and from people who are white, what I find that does make me feel like I belong is, like, there's so many ways to be a person and to be you and to feel true to yourself. And I feel like when you come from a smaller community, it feels like you have to fit the prototype of the community to feel like you are actually belonging in that group. Like, you have to love cricket. That means that there's, like, less room for, you know, if you're a woman and you want to lift weights, like, there's less room for that because, like, there's just less numbers in the community versus, like, there's a ton of white people in the U.S. Like, there's a ton of white people in the U.S. And I feel like that's also where I found, like, since being in spaces where I've been able to, like, make friends with people of other ethnicities and races, and especially, like, make connections with people in Black communities, is that that's what I found in Black communities, is because, like, there's a level of, like, diversity within each community where, like, I know it has to do with, like, mobilization and, like, the representation that they see and that they've made, that the Black American community, well, communities, I want to say, like, have made in our society at large. But, like, how I see that in my own life and my own experience is that I see, like, this beautiful freedom to move and express in different ways, because there's going to be other people like you. And that's what I hear from my Black friends who talk about this. And it's, like, it's so interesting how you characterize that, because, like, for example, there are some spaces where I don't really see that. For example, I've got, like, some Black friends who are in classical music. Like, they feel really restrained because there's not that many Black people in classical music. And so, like, but they can tell that there's a difference being in that space versus being in a space where there are a lot of people from their own background. There are a lot of people from their own community. And, like, when you're from smaller and smaller communities, that gets harder. When your communities are more and more insular, when, like, there's so much more pressure to, like, everyone like cricket, everyone want lighter skin, everything like that, like, it's harder and harder for you to just be who you are, or even understand that maybe who you are is different from the person they want you to be.
100%. I will say that all three of us have this unique experience that allows for us to share our stories and then inspire other people mm-hmm. who are also feeling the same way that we feel, and growing up with friends who are not part, like normally part of our culture, experiencing different things because we've had Black friends or white friends or other friends in different cultures. That also allows for us to become more complex and diverse and educated on things that allow for people to say no longer, oh, it's not odd that there's Black people in classical music. Like, I think that mm-hmm. that is another thing that I feel like being Guyanese and Indo-Caribbean in spaces, especially in media and behind the scenes, you know, when I speak to my other friends who are also in the community, and we say, well, how many Indo-Caribbean influencers are there? And who are they? Mm-hmm. Because when I think about Vice President Kamala Harris's recent Diwali celebration, there were a lot, mm-hmm. and if not a majority, of Indian or Bengali influencers that were part of this beautiful celebration, but they're not the only ones to celebrate Diwali. When I look at the churches that I go to now, I actually enjoy the church experience that include people, all different types of Guyanese people. And that's from Black Guyanese to Indo-Guyanese. Mm-hmm. But then also there's Chinese Guyanese. And then there's people who are, you know, more native or Arawak Indian Guyanese. Like, there is such a large mm-hmm. diaspora and beautiful part of our culture. And I feel like I might not have enough following to be invited to the vice president's, you know, Diwali celebration, but I also celebrate Diwali and probably go to church than most of those influencers there, you know, or like, you know.
I think you should have been invited.
It's next coming.
She might hear this.
Let's talk to her, Ray, in our weekly calls with Kamala.
I mean,
let's drop this.
A Jamaican descendant, and think about like the milestones mm-hmm. and celebrations that were given to our vice president when, you know, she was elected. I love that how many communities can say that's my vice president and represent that. But also when I see something as precious to me, as I'm lighting diaz outside on my porch, I said there's a whole bunch mm-hmm. of people who have ill represented Caribbean culture. For example, Lily Singh appropriated Caribbean culture recently by saying this is the music that she grew up on, when there's actually Caribbean influencers who continue to promote the community and do well by the community to promote their music and our culture. And she's getting thousands of likes and deals. And you know the reason why that's bad? Not that she celebrates our music, not because she was dancing to it, it's because there are people who are not within our community, who are not Asian, who are not Caribbean, who are going to look at her and say, she ticks another box for us, so yes. we're going to give her Caribbean opportunities. Hell no. Absolutely not. What we're not going mm-hmm. to do is allow people to fill up the spaces where there are already people who are fit to do that. Mm. And I think that's why it's so important for the work that you guys do. I think it's important for people to know that, going back to your comment, Catherine, about there being Black people in classical music, or there are Asians who love emo music.
I still like emo music, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
I didn't think you stopped. That's the reason why
okay,
I brought it up.
Okay, good.
But because...
Raise the representation.
Well, yeah. And because my favorite song that I sing during karaoke is Misery Business by Paramore.
When it comes to...
I was gonna bring up Paramore.
It's exactly. And I think that, you know, this is also really good because I am producing a shoot that I can't really speak to now, but, you know, it's coming out in a few months, but I also have to think about it as a producer, like, where a specific community sort of sits when it comes to the different places mm-hmm. and these different tropes that's put on them to say, oh, if you are a part of this community, you have to be, you know, listening to rap or hip hop, or if you're Caribbean, yes. you must do X, Y, Z. And that's the reason why I never fit in when I grew up, because my Guyanese accent is shit. I sound like a valley girl on most days.
Oh, God.
I probably will hate how my voice sounds in this recording later on, but I will say that it's not going to stop me from being who I am, because yeah. there are many people who are like me, who have my same experience. And there's a lot of young brown girls who do look up to me, and a lot of Indo-Caribbean girls who look up to me, that realizes that I don't have to be mm-hmm. a specific way to fit in. And that's what my brand is. I don't have to be the way that everyone says. That's the reason why a lot of my photo shoots and videos that I do are placing myself, a brown girl, in fantastical places because it allows for me to see what I've always wished I saw, which is a brown girl in a castle. And that's not a Kate Sharma from Bridgerton, as much as I love her character. What is disheartening about that is that how I'm not Tamil. I can dress up as Queen Charlotte, great, because she is a Guyanese, you know, a British Guyanese actress, Golda Rocheville, love her. But when it comes to that, someone's going to say, oh, well, like, you're Indian. I'm like, actually, I'm not really Indian. Like, I've got to explain it to somebody.
You mentioned producing. So I want to just talk about your career because I think you have a very interesting career. You've been at VH1 for a long time. I'm just curious in terms of how you got started there. And you've been there for a long time. So what about VH1 that, you know, makes you stay with them?
Well, I will say that a lot of people will see the years that I've had under my belt at VH1 and assume, well, yeah, why did you stay? Or why are you still there? And I will say that every year at VH1 has never been the same for me. I don't think that a LinkedIn paragraph is long enough to describe what I've done there and how many different walks of life I've had there. I started off as 8 years ago as a social media intern. And that was when primarily editorial was the focus, not digital. So I was able to see the brand shift from editorial to digital and video in general and seeing algorithms shift across social platforms throughout the years. And
you stayed in front of that.
Yeah. And I've watched this brand be able to grow and evolve and be able to flourish in ways that allows for me to understand the social media world in general. But on top of that, I was able to work on the shows that I have always dreamt of working on as a kid, from leading award-winning social media campaigns from America's Next Top Model to shows, the biggest reality competition shows on RuPaul's Drag Race, to Love and Hip Hop, to a lot of scripted shows that people might not know about, from Daytime Divas to The Breaks to Hit the Floor. Being able to work on a multitude of shows that are different genres and different formats, that has been able to keep me excited throughout the years. Like any long-term relationship, it has ebbs and flows. It'll let you grow with it. It grows. It's my longest relationship, and it's beautiful. This is not about that, but it is. I think that the biggest misconception too is that how it's my only job. I think that that Caribbean and that Asian mentality kicks in when you're like, oh, I need more money, and I never had money growing up. So I also do a lot of freelance social media work that allows for me to be separate from my day job and allows for me to grow my own personal brand and also the brands of other people. So that allows for me to be in spaces like the Black Excellence Brunch, a brand that I have watched grown tremendously. It's founded by my really good friend, Trell Thomas. I've watched him be able to create a safe space for Black cultural tastemakers and allow for them to have opportunities, and myself, one of them, that allows for me to grow. And so I'll be in those spaces, but I know my place in them. But then I'll still have people come up to me like, girl, you're Black in some way, some shape or how. I'm like, maybe. But until I run a really thorough ancestry DNA, I'm Indo-Caribbean for last time I checked.
Yeah.
Unless something changes.
We're not going to push
some kind of database changes somehow. Something
definitely on my dad's side. Absolutely, 100%. But I will say that my career has definitely allowed for me to see how reality TV has evolved. It allows for me to see how behind the scenes, how things work. I was always a social producer on these shows. I've always been a social producer on set. I've always been that point person when it comes to my designated show. But now that I've evolved to solely working on VH1 brand social, I've been able to work with my colleagues at MTV and create soul-focused Heritage Month shoots, like what I've done for Caribbean American Heritage Month to Latinx Heritage Month and upcoming projects across Black History Month and so on, so much more. It allows for me to be able to tell stories in an authentic way and also a relatable way for our audience.
Since you've been like in the media space in the editorial days and pre-digital age and in terms of pre of how it is today, I'm curious from your perspective, what the general make of like diversity and representation was like back then. Has it been something that was lacking when you first started and then you helped push for that and continue to push for that? I'm not accusing VH1 didn't have that, but just in general in that media space.
Yeah, the entire industry.
And then to today where you are seeing more and more, still a lot of work to be done for sure, but definitely in terms of the progress, we've made a lot of progress. From your perspective, how has that trajectory like gone? Has that been pretty surprising for you, like if you're looking back at it and be like, oh yeah, we've made long strides, or is it stuff that people just, you know, stuff like myself, Catherine, most general public still don't see a lot of the things that, you know, we see on TV and on the screens that happen behind the scenes that still need push for diversity and representation?
That's a beautiful question in so many ways, because there is a number of ways to look at it. I will say that it's kind of one of those things where don't meet your heroes sometimes. And I will say the other times, I will say that because it's not particularly based around people. It's based around the things that you want to work on. So for me, I said, you know, think about it growing up, the shows that you watch, and then think about the way you're represented and also the people who you would think are behind them. There are people who I've seen who are white that can speak very well and create and contribute into Black culture. And there are people who just cross-pollinate in that way. Those are rare breeds. Those are people who, luckily, I know a lot of them who are able to respectfully speak about other cultures, who can speak in other voices for different communities and not disrespect them in the same light. Not every brand has that luxury, because that has to do with the individuals themselves and how we've evolved as a people.
Yes.
But I will say that when it comes to seeing something unfold on TV and then working behind the scenes, there's many times that I've been surprised about the people who work on them. And there's many times that I am surprised who is and isn't or should be working on them.
Mm.
And a lot of times that comes
with... Ain't that the truth?
It comes with... And I think that the audience can feel that now.
Oh, yeah.
Because they know what authentic stories about their culture is being told. For me, there aren't that many Caribbean-related shows that have to speak to the Indo-Caribbean experience. And I'm sure that that is my purpose on this earth, is to allow those stories and use my power and privilege to have those stories be told in the most authentic way. And that's also the reason why I'm going to school for producing soon. So hot off the presses, I am going back to school for digital cinematography, because I want to be able to learn how to share stories about my culture and our culture in the most authentic way. So that way, when someone is just like any one of us watching it, they're like, that person's got to be within the community. So that way they're not going to doubt it or question it. So when they Google and schmoogle and they see, oh yeah, it is someone who is part of the community speaking authentically about my stories. That always doesn't work for a lot of people. We know that there are people in the minority communities that have been sellouts when it comes to our culture for a paycheck. But I will say, I don't know them personally, thank goodness. But when it comes to the other part about it, and I feel like I'm kind of forgetting your question there, Raymond.
Oh, this is great. Forget about his question. I want to hear what you have to say.
I'm trying to... Because you're speaking about 8 years of seeing a landscape change.
Yeah.
And it's and luckily when it comes to... Well, now I remember my thought. Growing up in high school, I will never be that star. Like, I will never preach and praise that I was a straight A, you know, Indian, you know, girl in school who got just A pluses across the board. Sorry. No, I used to cut class to go see the Jonas Brothers.
Jonas Brothers.
Oh, 100%. I have them to thank for me having my career today, because...
Shout out Jonas Brothers.
Oh, 100%. Being able to meet celebrities and like chase them around New York City allowed for me to kind of, you know, kind of like look at the people who make them famous. The publicists, the agents,
TV shows,
the everything. So the machine and the people who actually had the real power. And because I became friends with those people, I was able to meet other celebrities. And after a while, it became less of a thing of meeting actual celebrities. It was more so being in the industry. I got an extensive background in publicity, but I also learned about television in college. So that allowed for me to like really, you know, help my career and set myself apart at VH1 for years. You can be the change that you wish you see out there. So yes. I've always wanted to capture content on the red carpet of the biggest award shows. And that's what I currently do now for my day job. So working on VH1 shows to also being on the red carpet at the VMAs or the Movie and TV Awards, where I'm creating and capturing content that I used to sit in my room and be on Twitter and be like, oh my gosh, what are they wearing? What's Selena Gomez wearing? What's Taylor Swift? You know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, that happened where I literally captured content of Taylor Swift right in front of me. And I was not fazed by it because I had met her so many times in the past when she started off in her career that it was kind of surreal that I was like, well, I manifested this. I knew that I was going to be here. I knew that I made a promise to myself that I wasn't going to meet celebrities behind a barricade anymore. And I did just that. And I think that sometimes, and luckily there are so many people on my team who are also come from the background that I do. And there are many people who come from the same background as me, so they're able to understand what I mean by that. Because growing up with the J14s and the Tiger Beat and the different Teen Bopper magazines, seeing those things come into light and then also knowing how they come into light gives you a different perspective on this world, but it also makes you want to delete all of your social media. I cannot delete my Facebook as much as I want to.
Right.
As much as I want to be disconnected from social media, I can't.
Yeah, it's your job. And I will say, too, what's interesting is, you know, for our listeners, it's not as simple when you're on the red carpet, you're producing content. I'm sure it's not easy, right? You're not just standing there observing and like, ooh, wow,
it's
cool.
It's coordination.
In your brain, you're going, okay, what's the shot here? What's the content that we're going to produce? Mm-hmm. You're having these thoughts already, I'm sure, kind of as it's going live. So that way you're prepared to produce it at the end of the day. And, you know, for me, like in my job, like I'm a producer, like it's so demanding, but it is a labor of love. It is fun, but it is something that you have to work on. It's like a full day too. It's not you're like on it, working on things, completing these tasks. So one of the things too, I saw that you produced was Black Girl Beauty, which is the show. You're the creative producer for Black Girl Beauty on VH1.
And the creator, yes.
What's been the most important takeaway for you from that experience?
I will say that Nevermind, that show was a one-off and has been produced years ago. I still have people who come up to me and talk to me about it because it's also inspired so many other amazing Black creatives in the industry to create their own series, but also can speak from their own experiences. So I'm really glad that Black Girl Beauty definitely catapulted and launched more spaces for these conversations to be had. Mm-hmm. I don't like what people do in the industry that says, oh, well, if I made this, then I am the only one. No, there are going to be other people who are inspired by many other creatives stuff that I do, and that is the whole point of being an influencer. That is the whole point of being someone who wants to embody and create change, is that you're also allowing people to share in that experience. And never mind that there are so many parts of producing that project and creating that project where every person on my set had to be African-American, Black, just and a part of the culture in general, because I wanted to ensure that everyone felt included. And that happened also with on set for Caribbean American Heritage Month for VH1. I made sure everybody on my set was Caribbean there because I want them to also know that there is someone out there that is looking out for them. When it comes to Black Girl Beauty, that allowed for me to spark conversations and really see how the beauty industry as an influencer, but also as a professional makeup artist, a somewhat model on different days, to also a producer, someone behind the scenes.
Horse model.
It allowed for me to be able to put the hands of the conversation into experts, but also be able to, again, spark conversations that people talk about behind the scenes, but they're not really brought to the forefront. So that sort of strategy, which is a very simple strategy, It's not reinventing the wheel over here, but it's what I like to do with every single project that I have, because the more that we have more people doing these things, it's not going to get boring because there are many people who are still dealing with it. And that just goes to show that change has not happened enough for us to stay quiet about it. So I'm never going to stop talking about the cultural differences and representation in the beauty industry that only happened because a lot of people like myself were raising alarms and saying, hey, why is it that I don't see myself represented? There's still not a lot of Indo-Caribbean beauty influencers out there, but I can sit here and paint my face as much as I know, Catherine, you enjoy. I'm not getting paid for that. There are people who aren't saying, hey, you know, I'm going to hire Sarita because she checks a box for me when it comes to my diversity quota. I want to be able to be known for my talents, but also my culture. So that way my future generation mm-hmm. and other young Guyanese women and Indo-Caribbean women in general can see, hey, there's somebody who is like, that looks like me, that can meet all these people on the red carpet, that can produce content, that enacts change, that can be in something that's not what my parents told me would always make me money. I didn't have to go to years of medical school to be making good money, plain and simple. But mm-hmm. I also had to have a passion for what I did. How many times across our culture have we seen our people's talents be denied and suppressed because it yes. wasn't encouraged in their homes, within their friends, within media and TV in general? So there are many people who are talented as much as the average white person that gets celebrated for mediocrity mm-hmm. that a lot of people who are minorities don't get celebrated in that way.
Where would you like to see more Guyanese representation? Is it more in media, entertainment, politics, businesses, corporations?
I know, Catherine's whispering over here. I will say that there is a lot of representation for Caribbean people. There are a lot of people who are Caribbean behind the scenes, but they're Afro-Caribbean because a lot of Afro-Caribbean people that I know that are mm-hmm. in places of power are their actual Black American identity overtakes that. So it's very easy to feel assimilated into that category and also fit a different category, you know, and sit on the balances of two cultures. Whereas for straight up Indo-Caribbean people, especially Guyanese mm-hmm. people or Guyanese women, it's exactly what Catherine was whispering. Everywhere. We're not seen. There are people in the Midwest who don't know what a Guyanese person is or who it is.
There's like, people in New York who don't know what a Guyanese person is.
And that's shocking because we're everywhere. Yeah. And
we're everywhere, and yet we're nowhere somehow.
That is, yeah, exactly. We're everywhere, but yet nowhere. And I think that that has to, as speaking from my own home and experiences, and luckily my parents were not like this. Mm. My mother raised me to definitely ensure that I was different. And that's exactly what I've done. Because I don't think that we're encouraged, it starts from the home. We're not encouraged to do mm-hmm. these things that are different, that enact change. If you tell me, hey, name mm-hmm. a famous Guyanese sports person who's not a cricketer. Name a famous Guyanese athlete. Mm-hmm. Name a famous Guyanese inventor. Name a famous Guyanese. And mm-hmm. when I say the Indo-Caribbean, Indo-Guyanese, you know,
yes.
person in those spaces, I'm sure that they exist, but I don't know it, nor was I taught it. If I was taught that a little bit more growing up, sure, it would have changed my identity, but also there is going to come a time where I will, you know, procreate and be able to be an inspiration to people in the future mm-hmm. generations and myself. And regardless if they're fully Guyanese, half Guyanese, or just mixed in general, I still want them to know that how, like, our people and the women who came as indentured servants on a ship mm-hmm. from the middle of nowhere in India to the middle of nowhere in South America, that their voices matter mm-hmm. and their struggles was not for no reason. Mm. I don't want people to know that, oh, Caribbean women are only what Carnival, you know, puts out there. Yeah. I don't want people to know that Caribbean women and Guyanese women are just going to be doctors, lawyers, and that's it. Or home yeah. health aides, or just very specific boxes that our own community puts us in. And I think that once that old archaic way of thinking gets diminished, the same way that a lot of Asian communities, Indian, you know, mm-hmm. down to Chinese, to Japanese, to every single other part of Asian communities, once we stop telling our children, oh, you have to be those things because that's the only way you'll make money, then we'll be able to see a little bit more progress. So it starts a little bit more
yeah.
with the home.
And it's about the fear. It's about getting over it. Because, like, I know my mom, like, really wanted to encourage me to pursue my dreams. But anytime I said something about, like, doing something in media, doing something in music or the arts, she tensed up. And it's because she was afraid that I wouldn't have financial stability. Like, we didn't have financial stability when I was growing up. And she wanted that so badly for me. And that fear made her, like, fight against the dreams that I had. And really, like, the only thing that we can then bring to that is fearlessness. So, Sarita, I so appreciate your fearlessness in being able to talk and being able to just be, and also, like, show people. I think earlier in the interview, you were talking about, like, oh, you know, we're not really encouraged to show the mechanics of what we do, to talk about, you know, you go to the gym, what do you do at the gym? Like, what are these other, you know, things you do to be you and to feel real?
Well, I mean, and I have my mother to thank for that fearlessness, truly 100%. My parents were immigrants, you know, like we came to this country with nothing. We had nothing. I know what poverty is. Mm. I know what it's like to come from literally nothing and build everything that I have to this day. And I think that,
yes,
I think that a lot of times we don't give our parents the grace that maybe now that I do, because they saw what would happen to us when we pursue things that were not money making yeah. industries or jobs, because they know that we're not white. They know that how like mm. you can be the star of an artist when you're white because you might have mommy and daddy's money. And I think that because maybe they're a little bit more aware mm. of that privilege before we, you know, saw it for ourselves and came into different spaces and communities where I'm sure like Raymond, like you saw how your friends lived, you know, after a while, then you're like, oh, this is not how I lived. I would never be able to talk to my mom like this, or I would never yeah. be able to have this luxury. And I just remember, God bless her soul, but I had a friend who told me, wow, Sarita, you just struggled so much growing up. I struggled growing up. And it came from a very good place in her heart. But other friends mm-hmm. who were also white turned around and told her, you don't want that. And if you've listened to Sarita her whole entire life and the stories that she shared about her life, she's telling you that how mm. you should be very grateful that you have everything around you, that you've never had to worry about a home growing up. You never had to do those things. And again, like I said, it came from a place of love and understanding, but she'll never probably understand where I come from. And I think that that's also what makes yeah. my journey difficult, because there are many people and men within my culture who wants to leave our culture. And then mm. a lot of times the women within our culture yes. wants to explore out of our culture because we feel that there are people outside of our culture who appreciates it a little bit more, and sometimes probably a little bit more educated about our culture than we are.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You hinted at, you know, in the future, maybe, you know, starting a family. Is that something that is in the near future? Is that where you are in your career? Like, or is that determined by where you are in the career? I'm curious in terms of, you know, what your view is family.
I love that you asked a serious question and Catherine's just laughing right now. He's being serious.
Yeah, I want to know you're.
He's being serious. I believe you. I'm not saying it's a joke. I'm just saying that, like, that is an incredibly personal question to ask.
Oh, no. I think it's more of, like, you know, when it comes to, like, preserving our culture, I've been thinking about this lately, mm-hmm. too. I'm first generation, and I'm concerned that as the generations continue going on, like, I don't speak Vietnamese and Chinese, and language is such a big mm-hmm. part of culture. Now, there's a lot of, like, nuances and things that I'm into. But a lot of it hasn't been passed down from my parents. Some of it is my choice. Some of it is just from lost in translation. So for you, if starting a family is something that you want to do eventually, you know, how do you approach preserving your culture and, you know, ensuring that the Indo-Caribbean culture stays within your family unit?
I will say that, and that is a really important question, because we talk so much about the way that we grew up around our friends, grew up in general and around our friends and the different friend groups that we have, that definitely has influenced my sort of dating mm-hmm. preferences. And I definitely have been quoted, and people have clipped this out and sent it to me, that I said I would never wake up at 4 a.m. and clap roti for a man ever in my life. Or that was the assumption, that man would be also a Caribbean man. Mm. It wasn't until I dated a white man who wanted me to do just that, then I realized, shit. Mm.
It was not the Caribbean. It was the man.
It was the man. So it was, you know, he can't see it, but it's just kind of like... It was more so that my mother also said, well, see, you try to get away from it and you couldn't, because right. that person is very well aware. I mean, we can also talk about the fetishization of our, you know, women in general, but, and it happens to men too. That's a whole other kind. I'm a very interesting person. I could talk about everything for days.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I will say
if the listener hasn't gotten that from this point, they should know for sure.
Yeah.
You're a very interesting person.
This is your best episode.
I think people have picked up on it.
I will say that, to answer your question in all seriousness, it wasn't until that I continued what I realized, and that's a beautiful thing about dating, because you should be dating and eventually find your soulmate or whoever you choose and to settle down with and have children with. Great. Love that for y'all. But I will say that it's after 8 o'clock. This is what you get. I will say that when it comes
to Ray, you're West Coast.
Oh, trust and believe. It does weigh heavily on me on what my future looks like, because I did grow up, unfortunately, being attracted to a little bit more of people outside of my culture than I did the men within my culture. And I will say that has to do with the men within my culture not being seen as romantic interests. Growing up and only reading romance books or watching romantic movies where the white man was considered a sign of beauty. Whereas growing up now and dating more so outside of my culture, seeing how someone could be a little bit more mediocre than myself and my beauty still be a problem when it comes to dating, because I know my value and my worth, but then yet for some reason I'm still not good or valuable enough versus someone who would be chosen out of comfort. That is something that I will say that I've had to deal with recently, because there's many times that I've had to explain my culture to particular men that I've dated. And some of them have been receptive to the point where they've offered or asked me to make food for my culture or do that. But if they know me or have listened to me well enough, they would know that I'm still coming to terms with my identity. And I still don't know how to make chicken curry. And I still, you know, I still have a lot to learn about myself. So you either have to be someone really important for me to actually really connect with my culture in that way and do that. Not to say that I don't eat chicken curry every single day and debate with your mama about if it's curry chicken or chicken curry, but I will say,
it's chicken curry.
Thank you. I have one ally here, but, but I will say that when it comes to, luckily, and hopefully everyone gets the opportunity to choose a person they have children with. And I feel like it's important for me that regardless of their race or ethnicity, that that person would allow for me to bring my culture in the way that I choose to bring my culture within the relationship. Like, there are people who are heavily Guyanese and very much GT pride, and I love that for them, or very much heavily Caribbean, but probably there are elements to that Indo-Caribbeanness that they have not taken part of. For me, where I call home or where I want to take my kids or where I want to connect with my inner child is not in Georgetown, Guyana. It's actually Corozal Town, Belize. So it's like, for me, it's definitely a different experience. It's a different, it's a reason why a lot of the projects I did in 2022 allowed for me to connect with my inner child. It allowed for me to see myself in a different light. It actually allowed for me to come to terms with the fact that before this year, I barely told people that I was Indo-Caribbean, and I was definitely not proud of where I came from. And I think that it was less more of proud of where I came from to not understanding or knowing that how I have the option of accepting my culture and being proud of my culture in my own way. And that way is not hurtful or demeaning to other people. I'm sure that, Catherine, you're not waving around a giant Guyanese flag on Liberty Avenue blasting.
I try, but they don't know what it is.
No, they should. Correction, on Liberty Avenue.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, like.
Okay. No, I got you. People who are listening aren't going to know this, but Liberty Avenue is like the most Guyanese people on the continent of North America.
Probably. And Richmond Hill in general. Yeah.
This is in New York?
Yes. Yeah. This is in New York and Queens. Yeah.
100%. And even if...
Take the A train till it ends.
You know, what's actually very interesting, because you're also based in the West Coast, I've been going to LA for 7 years. And multiple times a year, it is almost my second home. I know people who are, you know, Caribbean there. A lot of people who are Afro-Caribbean there. But I don't know a single Indo-Caribbean person there.
Me and neither.
I think that how it's not to say that they don't exist, it's not to say that they're not there, but it's also like, it's weird to even admit that my safe space, unfortunately, just does not have anybody that I see in myself. And I feel like a lot of people will say, no, you're supposed to be proud of your culture. No, there are a lot of people who feel the exact same way that I do. And I will not budge or force to conform myself to fit in or to make someone else feel okay or comfortable. If you grew up your whole entire life feeling comfortable with the way that one thing is, it doesn't mean that my opinion or my, you know, upbringing is damaging to you. I did not grow up in Guyana. I was born there. I spent a very short time there, but my developing years lied with a different country. And mm-hmm. even if, again, being surrounded by so many Guyanese people in Queens, I never grew to it. I never gravitated towards it. I think, and I've never admitted this out in public, but I think I cried at a Caribbean event. Like, I had a panic attack at a Caribbean event because I was so overwhelmed with the terms that I could not deal with my own culture.
Yeah.
That is something that people will be like, oh, you're just being a white woman right now. You're just being this type of way.
Oh, no. My gosh.
If someone says, oh, are you Guyanese? And I say, yes, I'm Guyanese. They don't have any doubt about it. I definitely am perceived and like present myself as a Guyanese woman. I will never not do that because that's mm-hmm. exactly who I am. But it does not negate the fact that I've been in spaces where my culture was so overwhelming to me because I had no understanding or meaning or appreciation behind it. And I think for anyone to admit that, it is very bold and brave.
100%.
Because there are people who are saying,
yes.
Oh, well, I grew up in Queens. I did grow up in Queens my whole entire life. I did go and grow up and shop on Jamaica Avenue and went to not Sybil's, but like a Parshram, like West Indian grocery store on Liberty Avenue. Like, these are like different things. I grew up in that space, but you cannot force someone to be its particular type of way if they went to school and it was mostly, you know, Black people or mostly Asians or mostly white people. You can't force me to do that, but I'm glad that I now have come to terms and have a greater appreciation for my culture because I can appreciate my culture and be able to properly represent myself. And the more that I've done that, the more that I found people who are similar to me.
I've also had a panic attack at events on Liberty Ave.
Thank you. It's overwhelming. Yeah. It's overwhelming.
I actually didn't piece it together until you, like, I didn't understand, like, what happened until you just explained what happened to you.
Therapy. This is a therapy session. This is what we talked about.
It is.
But it's...
We're paying you, right?
We pay you for you to...
No, our insurance. Did the check go through? Are you covered by our insurance?
I hope so. I got a check. That's one thing too, and I'm sure, Raymond, I don't know your background entirely, but I'm sure there's many spaces that you've been in culturally that like you probably don't feel like you fit in by any means.
Oh yeah. So I'm Chinese, half Chinese, half Vietnamese, first generation born here. And yeah, totally. I think when I go to Vietnamese events, and I would say, like, even though half and half, I culturally am maybe more aligned with Vietnamese culture in terms of just like I grew up in that environment more when I in my family. So when I go to those events, I don't speak the language. I do feel out of pocket sometimes. I do kind of stand out. I try not to let it get to me. I think it ebbs and flows. Some days I feel like I really wish I was more connected with my community. Some days I just say, you know what, this is my experience. I had my experience. That doesn't mean that I'm not Vietnamese. It may be there's just still a lot more for me to learn. So I totally get it, understand. I think that's the battle that we have to kind of deal with when growing up, being kind of removed from our quote unquote motherland culture. But I also think it's kind of it's the beauty of the makeup of this, you know, of our cultures and how we're really hitting that true diversity because people are speaking up more, like yourself, having open and honest conversations, and you can bring your personal experience. And the work that you do is so important. When the type of content that you produce, people see that and can relate to it.
I had two options last year. I either could have continued to self-sabotage and not allow myself mm-hmm. to grow and accept right. my culture, or I can think about the future of my kids and my family and what mm-hmm. I would like to impart on them. And I think that when I see how my nieces, my nephews, you know, are being raised, and when I think about how I want my kids being raised, my sister does an incredible job of letting them know that you might have been born in America, but this is where you came from. This is where mm-hmm. your grandmother, you know, on both sides, and your grandfather on both sides, this is where they came from. And mm-hmm. I think that because I didn't grow up in a very traditional Guyanese household, I was still faced with the same troubles and situations that many, you know, Caribbean households face when it comes to mental health, when it comes to body shaming, when it came to just toxic auntie culture in general. When it boils down to those things, I'm trying to say that mm-hmm. these situations and analyzing what I've experienced my 29 years on this earth allows for me to then say, That's not what I want for my kids. That's not what I want for my family. So I think that how to answer your very personal question earlier, yes, I do want to have kids, but I'm glad that I've gone through this journey and still going through it. So that way, when I do get to that stage in my life, and hopefully in the next few years, because, you know, inflation and taxes and in general,
you can't make plans.
No, and just exactly, you can't, you know, make plan, God laughs, you know, like, but I think that, but I think that it allows for me to get really serious about the type of future generation that I want to raise. And I want them to be proud as much as I am proud about my culture. Does that mean that I'm sending them on a first class flight to, you know, on Caribbean Airlines to see Kaichor Falls? No, that's actually not possible because you need to take a second plane to get there. But, you know, like, but I will say that, you know, I'm sure that you kind of, if, you know, fast forward to a future where I didn't go on this journey, I would be speaking in a space of inauthenticity to, is that a real word? I would be speaking from a space of inauthenticity to my children about who I am. So then I would then eventually be projected onto them because they would be part Guyanese in some way, shape, or form. So to kind of do what we try to do now, which is not inflict our generational trauma onto our future children or the future of the world around us, that's the reason why it's important that we go on these journeys to say, hey, I might not feel Indian enough when I go into the Patel Brothers, but I also know that I am confident enough that I can be Guyanese enough to go into a Guyanese space. And I might not, my accent might not be strong enough, but I can fully say that I am proud that I am Guyanese and proud of where I came from because it's where my ancestors came from. And I don't think that they came and they struggled through all of that for nothing.
That's a mic drop moment right there.
That, yeah, that's the perfect moment to end on because unfortunately we're out of time. I really appreciate you, Sarita, because you're just speaking truth through the entire time. And that's not easy. And I don't want this moment to pass without acknowledging, like, yes, that is brave. That is fearless. That is brown horse girl energy.
Please stop right saying there. That.
That's the name of this episode. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't think my equestrian trainer will be proud. She's like, she has to correct her post-in. She needs to tuck her hips more. No.
She'll be the next guest. She'll be the episode afterwards. She goes, I have something to
say. All right. Okay, so we're going to do a follow-up episode with your trainer.
Yes, you'll have to do a follow-up episode on that.
Sarita, how can people who are listening to this wonderful episode and they want to see and hear more of your truth, how can they connect with you?
I will say that the best way to get in touch with me is follow me on Instagram at Sarita Noth.
Yes.
And that's just really where I keep a lot of my business. And yeah, my email's there. If you ever have any questions, just let me know. I'm always down to help anybody who's willing to receive it.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Sarita. Thank you for your truth. Thank you for your fearlessness.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk again soon.
Great. Thank you guys so much for having me on your podcast and allowing me a safe space in order to express myself and share my journey and my stories. And
thank you.
It was an honor.
Real Talk Unfiltered is powered by Linda Yee as lead designer, Nico Buonasora as talent coordinator and social media manager, Catherine Ali Zaslavsky and Raymond Liu as producers, Tammy Cho, Michelle Hanabusa, and Tristan Paulet as our executive producers. Music by Jason Chu, Alan Z, and Mio Soul. Created by Catherine Ali Zaslavsky. And of course, everyone on the Hate is a Virus team.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Real Talk Unfiltered. For more episodes like this, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.
Follow our guests to keep up with their new projects and check out hateisavirus.org to learn more about our other initiatives. If you have questions or comments, message us on social media. We love hearing from you.
We'll see you next time on Real Talk Unfiltered.